you will remember that the Buddha said, it is because of visiting forces known as defilements that we suffer. And in his realization of how to address these defilements, he codified his response in what is known as the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path are those qualities of mind and behavior, right view, right thought, right mindfulness, right effort, right concentration, right action, right speech, right livelihood, that directly address the three gradients of kilesas, defilements. And the three gradients, or the three degrees, you might say, of defilement are, first, the most gross form, are what are called transgressive defilements. Those are when we act out of a defiled state of mind, we speak and we act in such a way as to transgress towards or against others and create disharmony. For that, the Buddha prescribed or taught the practice of sila, the three factors of the Eightfold Path known as right speech, right action, right livelihood. If we're able to exercise mindfulness of our intention and exercise restraint in acting on our states of mind, then we can overcome the transgressive defilements and, well, save ourselves a lot of suffering. But even if we can do that, the mind can still be quite obsessed with the defilements. And this is the second gradient, or a subtler form of defilements, when the mind is just tormented by any of these unwholesome states of mind. While exercising restraint and practicing sila keeps us from acting them out, they're still burning up the mind, and for that the Buddha taught a second practice, if you will, called samadhi, or calming the mind through right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. If we're able to exercise right effort and right mindfulness, as we have been here, at times and with momentum and the gradual development of the mind becomes collected. It becomes stable. And that is right concentration. And with that, the defilements are temporarily put aside in the mind. Well, to the degree that we can put aside the hindrances and the defilements in our mind, we experience immediate and substantial relief. No more anger, irritation, frustration, disappointment, longing, jealousy, envy, greed. Phew, what a relief. Temporarily. And for as long as we can sustain right effort, right mindfulness, and a momentum called right concentration, known as or felt as stability of mind, we can experience this relief from the defilements. But because our right effort is not always there, and our right mindfulness isn't always on a roll, and our right concentration isn't always stable, there are times when inevitably conditions change and we're dropped back into an obsessive, defiled state of mind. When the Buddha recognized this, he said, you know, we need something stronger than just stable mind to not only temporarily put aside the defilements in the mind, but to uproot them from the mind, to take them out of the mind's catalog of possibilities, if you will. And for that, the Buddha realized that he had to address the latent or the hidden or the dormant defilements that reside in the mind, just waiting to spring when we're a little careless, when we're not mindful, when a desirable object arises, attachment will be there. Or when an unpleasant object arises, aversion will be there. And so the Buddha offered a third training, which is the development of right view or right understanding and right thought. Those two factors of the Eightfold Path are the development of wisdom. It is through understanding things correctly, understanding the way it is, understanding the way things are, truly, deeply, that frees the mind from resorting to any of the defilements. If you deeply understand something, your mind just can't not understand it. In order to develop right view and right thought, to deeply understand the way it is, the way things are, requires the practice of vipassana. Okay? Mindfulness subdues the defilements temporarily. Vipassana, or the clear seeing that leads to understanding, uproots, or, well, initially banishes and ultimately uproots the defilements from the mind. Tonight I want to speak about the development of those understandings that uproot the defilements from the mind. We've talked about sila and speech and behavior a little bit. We'll speak more about it. We've talked a lot about the development of mindfulness or the awareness, the observing mind, to put aside the defilements or to understand the defilements. But it's vipassana that is the clear, profound, deep seeing into the inherent nature of experience. And this right view of vipassana, this wise understanding, comes from this direct observation that we've been engaged in. When we observe moment by moment, we observe and collect data. This collected data, when we collect enough of it, yields information. When we understand this information correctly, we have knowledge. And when we apply this knowledge, we have wisdom. So it is this right view from observing moment to moment that yields wisdom. And the wisdom, in this instance, is vipassana wisdom. Each moment, as you know, we are observing the nature of the body. Heat, cold, vibrating, pain, pleasant, tingling, and the whole catalog of physical experience. We're also observing directly the nature of mental function and mental activity. The mental functions of feeling, knowing, perceiving, and the mental functions of thinking, planning, commenting, narrating, understanding, liking, disliking. We're observing these moment to moment. And behind it all, we're observing and beginning to recognize the nature of the mind, which is to know. Once, or as the mind collects all this data of all these mental and physical phenomena, it begins to see something inherent in them which is universal to all of them. And what it sees are called the three universal characteristics. The three universal characteristics are anicca in Pali language, or impermanence, dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, or the conditioned or impersonal nature of phenomena. How could these three understandings, because that's what it is, it's the understanding of impermanence, the understanding of unsatisfactoriness, the understanding of the impersonality of phenomena that uproots from the mind the defilements. I want to speak about that tonight. Anicca means impermanence, momentariness. It means that something is subject to occur and then disappear. Now, we all know that. I mean, you know, seasons change. Day turns to night. People grow older. This is obviously a sign that things are impermanent. But that's not what we're talking about. Because that understanding that things change and therefore are impermanent is merely or purely conceptual. You can think it out. You can see day turns to night, turns to day. People grow older year by year. Seasons change. That level of understanding impermanence is not powerful enough to uproot the defilements. While it is understanding impermanence, it is not powerful enough to uproot the defilements. It can be used to, that level of understanding can be used to kind of make some adjustments in your life, you know, prepare to grow old, not be surprised when the weather turns bad, you know, expect that, you know, the body's going to be well sometimes and not well other times. Okay. If we can cognitively reframe our unrealistic hopes about life through this understanding of impermanence, great. But it doesn't essentially touch the defilements residing in the mind. Because it is said that the empirical insight or the empirical knowledge that we gain through direct observation of insight is hidden by the massive continuity of phenomena. We see continuity where there really isn't any. You know, we get up every morning, we look in the mirror, and we see the same person we saw in the mirror late at night before we went to bed. Pretty much. Well, it depends on how clear we were seeing, I suppose. But nevertheless, You know, there isn't any of us that sees a totally different person there, or believes it to be. We assume a continuity from past to present. When we meet someone after a year's absence, we assume that there has been a continuity in them. Well, this continuity is a fiction. We can observe this fiction when we pay really close attention on a moment-to-moment basis to our own mind and body. And we see that the body isn't the same from one moment to the next. And what you experience today has nothing to do with, or I should say, really isn't connected to what you experienced yesterday, or especially 5 years ago. The mind, too, is just as changeable. While we like to assume that there is a continuity to our beliefs and thoughts and feelings and emotions and judgments, well, take a look. You know, the mind is just ever-changing, and it's only through heavy editing are we able to, well, I should say selective editing, are we able to sustain the figment that, you know, our mind is the same today as it was yesterday, or that we believe the same thing, or that we see the same thing, or that we feel the same way towards another person or about things. It would be too disruptive in our life to really acknowledge and live the dramatic and radical change that's happening in our mind and body, honestly. It would. But by clearly observing moment to moment, we see this change. The appearance of continuity is broken. We see that the mind is segmented, if you will. That physical phenomena, physical experience is segmented, if you will. We clearly see that one moment is followed by another moment. Yeah, there's a connection, cause and effect, but it doesn't take too many of those moments before it looks very different from what it was before. At this pixelated view of reality, I call it the pixelated view of reality, where you just see that reality as we assume it to be is just this three-dimensional, multifaceted tapestry. Sights, sounds, colors, tastes, touch, smells, thoughts. That's all there is in life. And yet, you know, it's just little pixels. It's just little flickers of color, taste, touch, thought. We glue them all together into, this is it. We're listening to a Dharma talk at Cloud Mountain in the year 2007, July 5th. You know what? We make this up out of all of this colors, sounds, shapes, thoughts, and we glue it all together with mindlessness. And you pour a little mindfulness on the program, it's like it all falls apart into just disparate little moments of experience. Well, it can shake up our world when we see the deep impermanence of everything in our life. So, what this practice asks of us is to gradually come to terms with the truth of impermanence, the fact that things change, the fact that our minds change, our bodies change, feelings change, everything about us, well, everything about everybody else in our life too, is in constant flux, changing. You know the disappointment you feel when you meet a friend after a long absence and they're no longer how you remembered them? Or, you know, you return home to your spouse at the end of a retreat And they look, well, a little different than when you left. Or your feelings about, you know, your teacher. Flying high on one retreat, well, leveled out at the next, and heading south later. I mean, it happens. We need to accommodate. We need to learn how to accommodate all this change, all this flux, all this, well, unpredictable change. And that's what we do. In this practice, we learn how to be with the present moment, seeing that it changes, and developing the understanding that, not only the understanding, but learning how to live with the experience of such radical change. And withstand the sense of loss, the sense of, you know, things aren't the way I expected them to be. We see how fragile expectations are, how much suffering they can bring. Because we're assuming that things are going to stay the same. They don't. Years ago, I was, well, decades ago, I was in the long, slow dissolution of a long relationship. And it was painful. And it was just an inability on my part, well, both of our parts, to acknowledge that things just weren't the same. I used to insist, remember the way things used to be? That's the way they still are. They weren't. And it was a painful realization of the loss of that and the inability to do anything about it. It requires learning how to grieve. Learning how to grieve loss. A large part of practice is learning how to grieve the loss of everything you've ever experienced. Remember that good sitting you had last retreat or earlier in this retreat? It's gone. It is never coming back. Get over it. You know? It's gone. It's lost. Grieve the loss. Get on with being here present. The Buddha says, do not revive the past. Do not build hopes on the future. The past has been left behind and the future has not yet arrived. Instead, see with insight each presently arisen state, know that and be sure of it. Invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow, who knows, death may come. There is no bargain we can make with mortality to keep it at bay. So, this is the characteristic of impermanence. In spite of it, we still try to build solid, stable, unchanging relationships, structures, financial resources. Everything in our life is kind of moving in that way to try to build in stability in what is essentially radically unstable. No wonder we struggle. No wonder we suffer. No wonder we're unhappy. We're living with a wrong understanding of reality. Struggling against the way it is. This practice makes us wake up to it. To really wake up and learn to live from that place of understanding everything is constantly changing all the time. And rather than struggle with it, accept and, you know, adjust. The second characteristic, universal to all phenomena, experience, is called dukkha. It's the dukkha characteristic. Normally in life, we seek to maximize pleasure. I think there's an assumption that the more pleasure we experience, physical pleasure, emotional pleasure, financial pleasure, social pleasure, the more pleasure we experience, the happier we'll be. Well, we've all been doing that for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or more decades. How are we doing? Well, no doubt we've all experienced a lot of pleasure. And we have, you know, tried to put together a lot of resources to secure our future pleasure. And yet, there are still leaks in the dike, if you will. Dukkha means pain. Life is just full of pain. Emotional pain, mental pain, like loneliness, fear, depression, anxiety, jealousy, envy, confusion, feeling discriminated against, prejudice. And we all have experienced all of these, well, a lot. And yet, isn't it interesting that when a real bout of pain arises, we think, oh, it's a mistake. It shouldn't be happening. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. But that's the way it is. Or we take physical pain. There's all kinds of physical pain in our lives. You know, there's the obvious, you know, pain of disease and the pain of discomfort and the pain of, you know, just growing old and jamming your thumb in the car door and, you know, this, you know, feeling hungry, feeling sleepy, not being able to sleep. Or, you know, having eaten too much. There's pain. And we all experience a lot of that too. And yet, somehow, when we're really experiencing pain, we think there's something wrong. Actually, that's the way it is. You're really actually just getting in touch with, you know, what's right. This is the way it is. The body is full of pain. We don't see it because a lot. We don't see it often because, well, our society doesn't lead us to it. It offers every possible distraction and pain pill to obscure it, to hide it. And as long as we keep moving, we don't notice it, or only when it catches up with us. It is said that continually moving the body obscures the truth of dukkha. Well, you come on retreat and you sit still. Hey, it doesn't take 15 minutes, you know, and you see the truth. But you know what? Even with this, we still think, oh, this is a mistake. I haven't quite got the right cushion. I haven't got this, I haven't got that, I tried this, I tried that. I gotta do a little more yoga, I gotta do a little of this, I gotta sleep a little more, I gotta sit a little straighter, whatever. You know, and then I'll be pain-free. No, you won't. If you sit still and pay attention, you're gonna experience discomfort in the body. That's the nature of the body. But it is so hard to open to this truth. We think, you know, there's something wrong with me. You know, instead of saying, oh yeah, this is the way it is, right. Now I gotta learn to live with it. But slowly and gradually, if we keep paying attention, if we keep being mindful and pay attention, we're gonna have to deal with it. We're gonna have to find another way of relating to inevitable pain, physical and mental and emotional. We have to. It's a fact of life. There's another, experience of dukkha to be, open to also. And that is, the fact that since everything changes, whatever we are relying on for a sense of security, safety, and protection in our life also changes. And when that or those conditions change, we are left with insecurity, fear, vulnerability, and as we know, conditions can change immediately, overnight. all that we have relied on, or all that we are continuing to rely on for our sense of well-being and happiness, security in life, poof. Just like that. And, well, until and unless we practice, our happiness goes with it. We are vulnerable. Our happiness is unstable. And somewhere, just on the periphery of our awareness, we know that. And so we keep struggling and striving and kind of trying to patch up more support for, well, the inevitable, really. That level of insecurity that cannot be can't get away from it. There's not enough stuff in the world. There's not enough things in the world. There's not enough people in the world to provide that for you. However, this practice would ask us to look at this. Look at this fact of insecurity, vulnerability. And by coming to understand that this is the way it is, with conditioned life, then ask us to find another way to relate to these conditions, to these unstable, ever-changing conditions. And it is through understanding the truth of dukkha and accommodating it in our life that we're able to escape that level of vulnerability. There's a third form of dukkha, or a third experience of dukkha that we come in contact with. Very difficult to see. Very difficult to see. But this practice will bring it into view. And there's a macro view and a micro view. The macro view is we're born. Our parents or other caregivers, doing the best they can, such as it is, provide for us. They feed us. They bathe us. They educate us. They love us. They coo and woo and wow and tease us. They just do everything to keep us as happy as we can be. Because if we're not happy, they're not happy. And so, you know, and they do this as best they can, 24/7 for several years. And gradually, we get the message that we're on our own. Now it's our responsibility to take care of this body. Feed it, bathe it, take it to the bathroom, brush its teeth, comb its hair, clean its ears, do all that stuff, you know, day in, day out. And not only do you have to take care of this body, you got to take care of this mind. You got to entertain it, you got to distract it, you got to keep it happy, you got to get it some love, you got to get it to express some love, because if you don't take care of the mind and keep it distracted, it's just like being on a retreat your whole life. You have to look at that thing, you know, and that mind, if you can't keep your mind distracted, well, how was your day? You know, it's hard to live with this mind, isn't it? It really is, because it's so demanding, it's so insistent, it's so fickle. You know, we don't know what it wants from one minute to the next, and even when we try to give it everything we can, it still finds a way to be frustrated, disappointed, unhappy, you know. Well, that's oppressive. That's oppressive. You know, that's dukkha. That's dukkha. You get a glimpse of that? That's dukkha. That's what dukkha means. But there's the micro view. That was the macro view. The micro view is we have these ears, we have these eyes, we have this tongue, nose, we have this body, and we have this mind. Six sense doors constantly being stimulated from the time we're born till the time we die. It's just kind of constant bombardment of sound, sights, well, sensations in the body and thoughts. It's like we're just being tormented by stuff just impinging and just coming at us all the time. And you can't get away from it. You can take drugs, you can go to sleep, doesn't matter. It's still there. It's still there. If you pay attention, you'll see it even more. When you wake up, there it is, waiting for you. Just kind of boom, 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 boom. You know, you can do whatever you want. You can try to distract yourself. You still have to feel sensations in the body, hear sounds that you might not want to hear, see sights, think thoughts, have feelings. It's just relentless. That too is oppressive. That's dukkha. Well, most of us have found pretty elaborate strategies for avoiding this knowledge. We keep ourselves moving. We keep ourselves busy. We keep ourselves distracted. We blame. We do all kinds of things to try not to see this truth. But then you come on a retreat, and those fearless people that sit up front tell you, this is the way it is. And you just kind of, you know, we kind of trick you into sitting and watching your mind and your body until you get it, until you see this is the way it is. We inspire you, we tell stories, we do all kinds of things just to try to get you to see, to cut through the denial, the avoidance, the minimizing, the distraction, so that you can uncover and discover this truth for yourself. Because until you really see the truth of dukkha, you won't do anything about it. That's a fact. If you don't see it, you won't realize it's a problem. When you do see it, then you realize what a problem it is. Continually changing the postures of the mind, the postures of the body, keeps us just kind of out of sight, keeps dukkha just out of sight, because we keep looking for something a little more pleasant. Change, sometimes. But as we, you know, develop our mindfulness, we begin to see that everything we experience has this quality. It's either painful, or if it's pleasant, it's subject to change. And, you know, when pleasant changes, it's not usually to more pleasant. Or eventually it's to less pleasant. Or it's just oppressive. The incessant bombardment, if you will. When we see this truth, that this is the way it is, we have to make some radical adjustments in our life on a moment-to-moment basis. We have to let go of a lot. Well, we're encouraged to let go because, you know what, we see that doesn't bring relief. Distracting ourselves doesn't bring relief. Pretending it doesn't exist doesn't bring relief. Minimizing the pain doesn't bring relief. It's through understanding this is the way it is that we can stop expecting it to be otherwise. That brings relief. It's understanding that brings relief. It's not things, stuff, activities, or people. I've told this story a couple times, but it's a great example of dukkha and how to be disentangled from it. As you know, we're building a sanctuary on a Dharma sanctuary on Maui, and we've been working with the county to get a more reliable supply of water to our properties. And by the way, we're almost there. But a couple of years ago, we weren't. And we were at the point of just coming to realize just how much it was going to cost, up in the $800,000 range. So I called up the deputy director of the water department and said, I'd like to have a discussion with you about possible ways of reducing the cost, our cost of this project. So schedule an appointment, and I went to him with my little agenda of 15 things that I thought, if we could change in the design or in the scheduling of things, could reduce the cost of the project. So he had his engineers and a couple of advisors, and there's about four of them and one of me, and went to this office, handed out the agenda and said, thank you. Item number one, wouldn't it be possible to build like a 1,000-gallon tank instead of a 10,000-gallon tank, saving us about, you know, $150,000. So they talked about it and, you know, referred to the text and the, you know, the rules and regulations. And after a few minutes, they came back and said, no, it wouldn't be possible for that size pipe and this many people. We need a 10,000-gallon tank for fire protection. Okay. Well, wouldn't it be possible to reduce the size of the pipe from 8 inches to 6 inches? We're only supplying this small section of the neighborhood. And da, 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 da. You know, and again, they had another long discussion, and no, that wouldn't be possible either because the rules require XYZ. Okay, well, how about, you know, the rebate that you're going to give us over the course of 5 years for some of the expenses that we have to incur? Could you forgive us the rebate, you know, right up front so that we take out a loan and pay it back quickly? No, that wouldn't be possible either. So after a few more of these, the deputy director looked at me and he said, you're old enough to know, and you don't need me to tell you, life's unfair. Well, in that moment, my mind exploded into a rapid search for the appropriate defilement. Yeah. Anger, incredulity, frustration, rage, you know, just how, you know, it was just like, you could just imagine, it was just, you know, it was just, and this was just kind of zipping by my mind, just like, I don't really know how long I sat there, stunned. But my mind arrived at this place where it said, well, this is the way it is right now. And with that, all those defilements, gone from the mind. And on the heels of that acceptance, this is the way it is, came the understanding, oh, this can be dealt with. Relief. Not because anything had changed out there. It was still the same cost, same requirements, same guys, da da da. Understanding. Dukkha. This is really dukkha. This is really unsatisfactory. This is financially painful. This is really emotionally painful. But this is the way it is. Understanding and accepting this is the way it is. Immediate relief. Any one of us are going to have similar situations in our life. We're going to be faced with that. Only through understanding, only through having, well, I was so thankful for my practice. I could have, you know, stuck my foot in their mouth and, you know, and boy, I don't know how difficult it could have got, but I was lucky. You know, I had a little practice under me and arrived at the understanding fairly quickly and, you know, accepted that, well, we'll just deal with it. There's the characteristic of impermanence. Things change, grieve their loss, and get on with life. There's the characteristic of the unsatisfactory nature of all phenomena. Yeah, accept this is the way it is, and it can all be dealt with. There's a third characteristic that we begin to see gradually and eventually with more clarity and understanding, that there really is no inherent, essential, unchanging core to this body or mind. Ordinarily, though, we feel like there's someone in here. There's me. There's a doer, there's a feeler, the one who feels, the one who does, the one who makes all these decisions, the one who has kind of been tracking my life up to this point. That's the one inside me. And it really feels, you know, it really feels like there is some enduring, unchanging person in there. Well, this sense of self has been constructed in the mind by aggregating, gluing together, all of the experiences, all of the thoughts, all of the feelings we've ever had. And we glue them all together with self-identification, and it feels pretty substantial, pretty real, pretty like that's all there is there. Me. My thoughts are all about me. My feelings are my feelings. The body sensations are my body. When I'm sick, when my body's sick, I'm sick. You know, when I'm happy, when my mind is happy, I'm happy. And there's this pervasive and unshakable identification with all experience. Well, this is a useful fabrication. It's a useful figment of our imagination, if you will, because, you know, in life we need to have a pretty clear sense of ourself so that we can know our strengths and limitations and develop and maintain appropriate relationships and know what's ours and what's others and move through life. And we need this, it's a useful, recognizable pattern of mental and physical behavior. It's useful. It's recognizable. But it's just a figment of our imagination. This sense of self that we recreate with all of our decisions, and all of our reflections, is, it's unstable. When that sense of self that we rely on isn't confirmed or affirmed by external reality, we suffer. You know, the body kind of falls apart. People slander us, or people condemn us, or people judge us differently than we judge ourselves. And it's like, or, you know, our mind just goes off and does something that, well, we wouldn't do. Have you noticed? You know, the mind goes into places that it's like, wouldn't want anybody else to know. Well, you know, it's only again through kind of heavy editing and kind of like, you know, kind of dramatic sculpting of our internal life that we're able to present kind of a coherent, unified, you know, recognizable me to the world. Well, to ourselves, to the world, to others. And it takes a tremendous amount of time, energy, and editing to do that. Well, so we come and we sit down and we start paying attention to the mind and the body, to our memories, to our plans, to our feelings. And we realize there's a lot more going on here than, you know, we have been copping to. There's a lot more thoughts, feelings, memories, plans, ideas, insecurity, vulnerability, fear, jealousies, angers, rage, all kinds of leftover, you know, loose ends to our life that we don't see most of the time. Well, our sense of self gets a little, it has to expand, really, doesn't it? We have to kind of acknowledge, I'm not this little limited, I'm actually, you know, there's all of this going on, too, in here. When we identify with thoughts, feelings, memories, plans, physical sensations, we kind of glue it all together with identification. Mindfulness is the solvent that dissolves that identification and reveals just how pixelated life really is. We see, you know, just how, ephemeral, how thin, how evanescent the body is. We see how changeable and kind of conditioned the mind is. You know, all you got to do is have them ring the lunch bell 15 minutes late. Your mind is controlled by that bell. Really? you know, try it. Go down to breakfast, you know, at 7 o'clock and have a, see the sign that says breakfast won't be served this morning till 7:30. Every one of us would feel, you know, threatened or upset or, you know, I mean, we'd get over it pretty quick, but that's how vulnerable we are. I mean, the mind is not ours to control. Conditions, random conditions arise in the world and we get jerked around. Who do we think we are? Well, that's just the easy part. There's all kinds of surprises waiting for us in the real world. When we really look closely at this mind and body, this is what we see. That who we think we are, this sense of ourself, what we do and don't do, what we think and don't think, how we feel and don't feel, what our beliefs are, is all in flux. It's all changeable due to conditions that, well, are beyond our control. We do the best we can to kind of hold it together in life, but it's a struggle. It's painful, and reality often doesn't confirm it. What we see here in just paying attention to moment by moment experience is we see that, and we learn how to live with the fact that there is no kind of unchanging inherent core. Yes, there are habits. There are bad habits. There are good habits. But they too change. So what is it that we see? We see that the narrator in our head that's been telling us all about ourselves hasn't been telling the truth. Or tells us a story that often causes pain, suffering, unhappiness. I'll tell you about one of my stories. Years ago, I had to take a flight from San Francisco to Boston. And I was taking a morning flight to get there late in the day. Something changed. I had to get there a day earlier. So I called up the airlines and I said, do you have any empty seats on the red-eye flight, San Francisco to Boston, so I can get in the morning? They said, oh yeah, that plane's half empty. No problem. Drove down to the airport, went in. There was pandemonium at the airport. I went to the counter and I said, what's going on? You know, I thought this flight was going to be mostly empty. They said, oh, one of our flights to Boston got canceled. All those people on that flight are trying to get on this red-eye flight. And I said, oh, no, I want to fly that flight, but I want to fly standby. And they said, not a chance. There are so many people with reserved seats on the flight that got canceled. You're not going to get on. I said, well, just in case, could I go to the gate and wait? And this was back when you could go to the gate without a boarding pass. And so I said, okay. So I went up to the gate and I told the gate agent, I said, you know, I'm flying standby, and if there's a seat, I'd like to get on. And they said, well, you're one of three. And I said, yeah, but I'm a frequent flyer. I'm a premier frequent flyer. I fly a lot with you guys. You know, so, you know, if there's one seat, maybe, you know, you ought to see who's got the most miles and let them get on, right? He said, well, we'll see. So they tried to get everybody on the plane, and they filed everybody on and trying to get off on time. And as everybody had gotten on or was boarding the plane, they said to the three of us who were going to fly standby, come down the entryway to the door of the plane, and when everybody's seated, if there's any seats left over, we'll let you on. So I insisted on walking closest to the agent and saying, well, by the way, I'm a frequent flyer. You know, and if there's one seat, shouldn't I get it? And got to the plane. Finally, they got everybody sit down, and they said, one seat. Oh, I was so happy. I said, could I? There's one seat. And they said, okay, you can sit in that seat. Way up back between these two great big football players. You know, so I settled in my seat, just kind of squashed and had no room overhead, had to put my carry-on bag at my feet. You know, you're all cramped up. But I was happy. I was going to get to Boston on time. So I was just sitting there kind of getting settled in. And the agent found another seat back there, and they brought the second standby passenger on, set them down, closed the door, ready to push back. They did the destination check. This plane is going to Boston. If you're not intending to go to Boston, please let the flight attendant know. Sure enough, somebody in first class rings the bell and said, hey, I'm not going to Boston, or something like that. Well, they said, whoa, hold the door. They opened the door, let the person off, called the third person who wanted to fly standby. He said, come on, come on, come on. You can get on now. There's another seat. Put them in first class. I was not happy. I said, hey, I'm the frequent flyer. I'm the one with the most premier frequent flyer. I should have this seat. Ring the bell. You know, as they said, we're leaving on time. You got a seat. Sit down. So, whew, I was frothing. I was so upset that I didn't get the first class seat. So, first half hour on my flight to Boston, I was composing my letter to United Airlines saying how badly they treated their frequent flyers. And I was just upset. Then I realized I have another 5.5 hours of this. And I said, oh, what the heck? Let it go. Let go of that identity as being the premier frequent flyer who deserved special treatment from United Airlines. Let go of that and stop suffering. I got to Boston on time. I got to my whatever I had to go to, and it was fine. I'm still a frequent flyer. They still give me miles. Occasionally I get upgrades. What happened? The only thing that happened is I let go of my identity as being frequent flyer. And all that happened was I stopped suffering. Nothing else changed. Now I have to ask you, what story are you telling about yourself that's causing you suffering? Who do you think you are? What self-image have you constructed and keep telling yourself, this is who I am, and it still causes you suffering? No matter how long you have told yourself that story, it's just a story. You can let go of it anytime you want to stop suffering. Everything else stays the same. We see this in practice. We see the possibility of letting go. Just letting go of things that we've held on to for years. Fears, pains, roles, images, self-images, judgments, all kinds of things. We're just holding on because it's who we are. And we see it's not. Or when we see that it causes suffering, we can let go. It's our choice. But we only have that choice if we pay attention. If we see that we have that choice. If we see how, well, there really is no inherent, unchanging, substantial thing that that refers to. This is seeing the characteristic of anatta, or the selfless nature of things. These three characteristics, understanding the truth of impermanence, understanding the truth of unsatisfactoriness, understanding the characteristic of the impersonality or the conditionality of things, are tremendously liberating. They're not easy to come by. We don't arrive at these understandings through thinking, but through directly observing experience moment by moment, we begin to intuit, sense, and come to understand this is the way it is. And in that, we also learn to adapt to these truths, this understanding. And in this way, we free the mind from its limitations through understanding. This is the third training of the Noble Eightfold Path that uproots from the mind the wrong understanding of the way things are. And when we've uprooted from the mind the wrong understanding, it doesn't come back. It doesn't arise. Those defilements don't arise in the mind because we now see the truth of these three characteristics that they're inherent in all experience. This is just liberating. If you see it a little, you're a little bit liberated. If you see it a lot, you're very liberated. If you see it all the time, you're completely liberated. That's the nature of insight. That's the Vipassana knowledge that we gain through this practice. So let's sit for a moment. Let the words settle. Sayadaw says, when your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities change as well. And through such understanding, you will naturally practice more, and this will help you to do well in life.